I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time for Wisdom Watch, where we visit with respected elders, people who are not just smart, but wise. Today, the 15th president of Howard University, H. Patrick Swygert. After more than a decade at the helm of one of the nation's preeminent historically black universities, President Swygert has decided to move on in June after this year's commencement. And he's here with us today to look back at his presidency, to talk about what's next, and about his reflections on issues in education, philanthropy, and leadership. President Swygert, welcome. It's so great to have you here. Thank you so much.
It's my privilege to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
So much to talk about, but I really want to go all the way back. I don't know if most people looking at you today, somebody who's traveled all over the world, who's hosted all kinds of luminaries, if most people know that you are one of 13 children, raised in Philadelphia, lost your father as a senior in high school, and you were only able to attend Howard because your mother agreed to use some of your dad's insurance to help you get there. And I'm wondering how you think those early experiences shaped you.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to reflect. I lost my father, and in fact, the principal amount of money my mother had available to her was a death benefit that my father's employer paid, and it was rather modest. And my mother gave me half of that death benefit and a pat on the back, a kiss on the cheek, and said, "You're on your own, and good luck in Washington, D.C." And that half was more money than I'd ever seen. And in today's terms, it's very, very modest. But I was the first of my siblings to go off to college. And I came to Washington. And Washington did provide me with an opportunity. A young kid from Philadelphia could be in Washington for 3 days and at the end of the third day have two jobs. I'm not so sure you could do that today. I worked in the old Bond Bread Baking Company. And I had a job on campus. And in fact, the joke used to be that I came to Washington to work, not to go to college. But this was before the National Defense Loans, Spofford Loans, and Pell Grants, that sort of thing. And I worked, but I had lots of people around me who supported me.
So I do want to ask, what did you want to be when you grew up?
Just the other day, a high school classmate, someone who I have not seen in more than 40 years, sent me a copy of my high school yearbook photo. And it says, "Pat wants to be a lawyer." And I smile when I think of that, because to be 17 years of age and you want to be a lawyer, there's a question there. But but apparently I had this notion that if I could somehow get to college, the lawyer part would follow. I didn't think much beyond college. It was just to be a lawyer. And then when I got to Washington, remember, I came to Washington in 1961. And in 1961, most of the champions of the then burgeoning civil rights movement were very much alive and well and part of our daily environment at the university.
And you did become a lawyer. You were a double Howard. You were at Howard undergrad and Howard Law School. Before you became president of Howard, you were the president of the State University of New York at Albany. Wanted to ask, why did you become a college president or university president? Why did you want to?
I was reasonably happy as a law professor at Temple University in Philadelphia. When the then president of the university announced his retirement, one of the candidates to succeed him was the dean of Temple's law school, Peter Lear Course. Fast forward, Peter was elected president by the Board of Trustees. And one of the first things that he did was to tell me that all of the positions at the university were filled. And I said, "Well, thank you very much. Since I didn't ask, I appreciate the courtesy of just volunteering information." He said, No. He said, "They're filled, but I want you to work with me in any event." So we made up a title, and the title was Vice President for University Administration, which meant that my portfolio was made up of virtually everything that no one else wanted, frankly. Within 2 years, 2.5 years, I was named Executive Vice President of the university. And it was at that point that I thought, if I'm engaged in a very complex, very, very large urban university, and if I seem to be doing reasonably well at it, why not a presidency? In 1989, Dr. James Cheek announced his retirement as president of Howard after 20 years. And I was invited to be a candidate. Well, in its infinite wisdom and good judgment and good sense, I was non-selected by the Board of Trustees in 1989.
You know, it is not a secret that when you were selected, you faced some very difficult times at the university. I don't know how much people remember, but it was very public at the time and very painful. There were layoffs, declining enrollment. Congress wanted to drastically cut support for the university. You were the fourth president in 6 years. I wondered if you ever wondered whether you could do it, whether you were up to it.
Well, it's interesting that you put it that way. I think as an alum, one of the great joys is to have the opportunity to return to alma mater as president. For me, it was an opportunity really to say thank you, in one sense, to those faculty members and to those staff persons and classmates who had welcomed me years before. The other dimension of it, of course, is that, and I'm sure you went through the same thing in school, when you're sitting around the dormitory in the Rathskeller or in the Student Rec Center, and you
I never did that. I studied all the time.
Well,
24 hours.
Well, that's absolutely clear.
But I digress.
I majored in extracurricular activities, but I try to sit next to people like you. But, you know, you sit around, you're chewing the fat with your classmates, and you say things like, boy, you know, if I was president, this is what I would do at this place. I'd really get it together. Well, you do have the opportunity every now and again in life, and you see that it's not quite as easy as you might have thought.
You presided over the successful completion of a $250 million capital campaign. It is the largest capital campaign ever by an HBCU. You finished the campaign early, several months early, exceeded the target. And one of the other things that's noteworthy is that of the 51 of the million-dollar donors are alumni. Why do you think that's important?
Well, I think it's important in two respects. The first, of course, is the dollars themselves that go toward fulfilling your campaign goal. Secondly, and I think equally important, is that it sends a signal that the beneficiaries of the enterprise, the people who know it best, care about it and care about it in a way that can be quantifiable. I always thought that there was enormous, enormous love for alma mater. But there was enormous love for Morgan. There was enormous love for Spelman, for Morehouse. The question was, how do we tap into that? So that was the first thing. And then secondly, there is a fairly significant and growing community of upper middle class African Americans, and African Americans are quite wealthy, who come out of a tradition, principally church-based, but a tradition of giving. And so it's not alien to us, you know, this notion that blacks don't give and have never given. It's just simply not true.
You know, obviously dollars are important because one of the things you were brought in to do was to revive the institution, which was perceived as deteriorating in many ways, both physically and in terms of the relationships with faculty and so forth. But I wonder, because there's been so much emphasis on fundraising, because you've been so successful at it, I wonder if you ever worry about the opposite message, that dollars have become so important, that the motto of the university is truth and service, whether those fields that are money-making and that are glitzy are now becoming more valued over the kind of service with which, you know, Howard is so long identified, people who teach, people who really care for the diamond in the rough, which you clearly were.
Mm-hmm. I think about it all the time. Remember, Howard University is 141 years old, founded in 1867. Now, clearly, such an institution has not been sustained by dollars alone, because obviously if it was just about dollars, there would be no Howard University. The if you will, the raison d'etre for the institution, its mission, transcends everything. Because without that, you're simply just raising money, but for no good purpose. And by the way, I don't think you're going to be successful as well if you cannot articulate some form of vision. And I think Howard University and HBCUs writ large are still about two things: opportunity for youngsters who might not otherwise have an opportunity for education, post-secondary education. And secondly, to be about the business of the greater African diaspora. And what are those issues affecting us, whether it's healthcare disparities, whether it's environmental issues, whether it's traditional, classical civil rights issues, human rights issues. That's what they should be about, what we are about.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News, and I'm speaking with outgoing Howard University President H. Patrick Swigert. He leaves the office at the end of June. Speaking about the mission of the HBCUs, a lot has changed since you went to Howard, and even since you've been president. You in that initial address to the university, you mentioned that when you went to Howard, Howard selected. It did not recruit. Now Howard has to recruit, in part because, like, you know, a necessary and important social change is that African-American students are now welcome and even sought after by many institutions. I think I want to mention at this point that Howard graduates more African-American PhDs than any institution in the country. But it still raises the question for some people, which is, you know, is there really a need for an historically black college or university? And since these institutions now recruit people of other backgrounds, what do they really do?
I can't tell you the number of times over the years when I've called a youngster, and I call, you may have heard about this, I actually call students. And I'm calling a student because the student that I've just called, she probably has heard from either the provost or maybe the president at Brown. She's probably heard from the provost or maybe the president at USC, Steve Sample. They want the same kids that I want. But I want, remember, the other part of the dimension of our responsibility is opportunity. I want the youngsters like a Pat Swigert, who was given an opportunity at Howard, to be around those kinds of kids as well. So I want both communities. And I tell our recruiters all the time, you got to get out there and you got to, yes, share the history with them. Let them know this is where Frederick Douglass served as a trustee, important, where Dr. King came and preached on a regular basis, important. But it's also important to let these young people understand you're going to get a heck of an education here.
So what do you think that you offer that a student isn't going to get at USC or
sure.
at Harvard
sure.
or at Yale?
Sure, sure. The first thing we offer is just what I received as a student. It's an environment that can envelop you, if you're open to it, it can envelop you and can take away one issue that tragically continues to haunt lots of public discourse and lots of what we do, namely the notion that I'm being treated a certain way, responded to a certain way, looked at a certain way because I'm black or because I'm a person of color. You're not going to have that at Howard University. So if you're waiting in line and you're ticked off because the line is extraordinarily long, it ain't because you're black. You're there with everybody else.
Take that off the table.
That's the first thing. Secondly, I tell students when I'm out and about, don't look upon us as, okay, I'll go for the nurturing and the history, and I'll try to find some other way to complement that with education. Oh, no, no. You're going to get one heck of an education along with everything else.
Yeah. It's been much discussed in recent years that the job of a college or university president at an HBCU or wherever has gotten harder. But you have had your share of difficulties. I mean, about a year ago, the Faculty Senate sent a letter to the Board of Trustees criticizing your leadership, and you announced your resignation a couple of weeks later. I wanted to ask if that was painful to you and if that is, in fact, why you decided to resign or to retire.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question. Actually, I had notified the board sometime before that, it was my intention to retire. The Faculty Senate Council letter to the board had an interesting impact on the board in that the board asked me to stay. I said, no, we don't want you to go. If you were inclined to go before this, now we don't want you to go. But I thought at the time that it really was time. 13 years, that's quite a long period of time.
Well, why do you think that is, though? I mean, those criticisms of you were mirrored those of the reason I keep mentioning Harvard is that it just was interesting that there were similar complaints about high-handed leadership, didn't feel that keeping your eye on the ball of the core mission of the university,
right.
Complaints about the way resources were being, even though happy that you raised the money, not happy about how they felt you were managing the money. That's just, what do you think that is about? What do you think is going on?
Well, I've been involved in academia for 36 years, and I think the criticisms are more typical than not. Secondly, you know, in one sense, the criticism relative to fundraising in terms of our endowment, which has gone from $144 million to $530 million, I think as a faculty member, I think it's a good question to ask. Okay, you raise this money. Now what are you going to do with it? I think that was part of it. I think secondly, I suspect there is some truth to the notion of how I have conducted myself as president. One of the things that comes with age is a realization that you really don't know everything, But one of the other dimensions is that you probably know more than people think you know as well. And that is a balance. And maybe I've gone one way or the other. But
you think you got a little heavy-handed toward the end?
No, I'm not so sure heavy-handed. You know, I am who I am. And I don't in any way apologize for it. I respect and appreciate what other people not only have to say, but who they are.
What do you think your legacy will be? What would you like it to be?
Well, I'd like it to reflect my sense of commitment to the core values of the institution, first, to the students, second, and to the bright and engaged faculty of the university. If I can meet Mordecai Wyatt Johnson someday, if I can meet a James Madison Neighbor,
former presidents of the university.
And if they said to me that, you know, you did okay, that'd be fine.
What's next?
Well, next is some rest. I'm trying not to make a huge decision right now. And therefore, I'm kind of answering some phone calls and sort of not answering others. I'm answering all, but I mean, I'm trying to be courteous to folk, but letting them know I need a little bit of breathing room and I need a little time. If my actions mimicked or matched my rhetoric, then I would be engaged with young people, particularly young people in middle school who I think are most at risk of either going forward with their education or going backwards to something else. At least this has been what I've seen. I'm a sucker for kids who look like me, you know, like Pat Swigert. And I do think there is not just a giving back, but giving back something of value.
Will you keep us posted on whatever you choose to do next?
Most assuredly.
Glad you answered our phone call among the few that you are choosing to. You're answering them all, but among the ones you're responding to, we're glad you responded to our call. H. Patrick Swigert is the 15th president of Howard University. He was kind enough to join us here in our Washington studios. President Swigert, thank you so much for your good work, for visiting with us, and good luck to you.
Thank you so much. It's been my privilege.
Yesterday, the Board of Trustees of Howard University announced that Sidney Rabeau, currently president of Bowling Green State University in Bowling Green, Ohio, will succeed Mr. Swigert as the 16th president of Howard University. He will assume the new post on August 1st. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.